I'm about to speak with Professor Jay Richards. We'll talk about the coronavirus, how it impacts the economy. What does science say? How should we be responding as a government?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on The Line of Fire. The number to call, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Friends, as we look at the unprecedented times in which we're living, we look at the crisis with the virus and so many questions, the questions we all have, there are areas where I can answer. I've been writing about this, addressing this from day one, trying to put out words of wisdom and comfort and faith and guidance, but I'm not an economist, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a medical doctor. I don't understand how a lot of these things work. So that's where we rely on the wisdom and counsel of others. So I've reached out to Professor Jay Richards. He is a professor at Catholic University in economics and business. He is a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute. He is the senior editor for The Stream, stream.org, where I write on a just about daily basis. So he's an economist. He's a philosopher, theologian, scientist. And just the man I want to talk to with a bunch of questions I have, and I trust you have some as well. So if you have a question for Professor Richards, number to call, 866-34-TRUTH. Jay, thanks so much for joining us on the Live Fire today. Hope you're doing well.
Thanks so much. Yeah, doing very well. Thanks, Michael. Good to be with you.
It's kind of funny now, as I've reached out to folks to do Skype interviews and Zoom interviews and be on the air, seems people have more free time than normal.
I can tell you, for me, though, because I do a lot of that anyway, I'm spending 4 to 6 hours on Zoom and Skype, actually. But yeah. I don't have to waste time commuting, so that's major time saving.
Yeah, look, right now I should be on my way to Nigeria. So this
wow.
is, definitely quite a difference here. Yeah, same here. I'm used to doing stuff via Skype, Zoom, radio, and then writing. So we're busy. But, yes, so glad, sir, that you could join us. So I've got a bunch of questions. Some are really simple economically. Some really are more focused on what's happening now scientifically. But first and foremost, when you hear President Trump speaking now and talking about trying to get business back as usual within weeks, not months, Vice President Pence was on a conference call earlier today with conservative leaders, said the same thing. When you hear that, do you think that he knows things we don't know? Do you feel he's being reckless, responsible? What's your take?
No, I think what he's trying to do is he's trying to balance competing sides on this. Not just competing sides of people that have different opinions, but whenever you make a policy decision, this is, Michael, the most important thing I could possibly say that people could remember is that it's not a one-sided risk. And so if you do one thing, what you want is the benefits of your policy to outweigh the costs. And so right now on social media, as you know, people are saying, well, the trade-off is between saving people's lives and Wall Street and the Dow Jones Industrial Average. That is absolutely incorrect because the economy is about human beings. So if we end up with 20 or 30% unemployment, that's going to be lives of people. And President Trump, he's understood this from the beginning. He knew perfectly well, okay, look, we want to keep Americans safe, but we also know that if we devastate the economy, that's going to hurt people. It's going to kill people. And so what he's trying to do is he's trying to balance, okay, read the tea leaves on these epidemiological models to try to figure out, okay, how bad is this coronavirus going to be? How catchy is it? That is, you know, how easy is it to catch? And how deadly is it for people? And then balance that against really shutting down the economy effectively and the deaths and despair that will cause. And I think he's trying to find a happy medium. I do think that no matter who the president were, if it were President Trump or Hillary Clinton or whomever, we do need to be forgiving because the president, the commander-in-chief, is having to make decisions in which he weighs lives on all sides of the equation. That's what's going on.
Yeah. All right. So there are different approaches that have been taken to the virus. You have a collectivist society like China that can just clamp down. They can even suppress information getting in or out, but they can just clamp down and kind of order everything. You have South Korea, which is democratic, and yet they can have more intrusive control over people in the society with maybe less objection Then you have the way things have been handled, say, in Italy and then Germany and then America. So you've got all these different models. We didn't react exactly the same way as South Korea. We weren't testing people as quickly as South Korea was, for example. But they're quarantining certain people and otherwise trying to let life go on as normal. Is it too late for America to follow the South Korean model?
Well, it's too late, at least the kind of effects of this shutdown that have happened for the last 2 weeks. That's going to have an economic effect no matter what we do. I still think that the president could just decide, look, we're going to pivot, and rather than spending all of our resources, basically having everybody practically shelter in place, we're going to focus on the people that we know are high risk, both of catching it and of dying from it or dying from an associated illness. Focus on that and then just have the rest of us be much more careful, you know, stay out of crowds, wear masks whenever you're in public and things like that. But the people that were otherwise productive and are not part of the high-risk category, let us get back to work. I actually think that's the thing that I think that is probably where the president will end up. I think that's always made sense. As you said, we can't compare these countries because Korea is extremely dense in terms of its population. There's a huge number of the population is just right around Seoul in South Korea. The United States is very diverse. It's geographically diverse. There are places in which you've got farmers living really far apart from each other. That's totally different from Manhattan or something like that. And so I think a kind of one-size-fits-all strategy is not the greatest thing. Fortunately, the reality is that there's certain things the president doesn't have the power constitutionally to do, whereas state governors do have authority within their jurisdiction to do certain things. And so that's why we're seeing a bit of a patchwork response. That's actually the federalist constitutional order at work.
All right, so we look at the different potential responses and, you know, questions, why is Germany keeping the death rate lower? Why is it so high in Italy? And obviously lots of different factors tie in. That's why it's so complex and so difficult for your average person sitting there trying to make sense out of all this. But you have an article co-authored today that's up on the stream, stream.org, saying that the mortality rate may not be as bad as expected. I saw an article, I think in the Jerusalem Post yesterday, by a fellow says, look, I'm not a doctor, but I sell medical supplies. That's what we do. And I'm tracking these curves and seem to have similar data that things are peaking at a certain point and then going down. So please explain what you wrote about in the article.
Absolutely. And I need to give credit to Doug Axe, a biologist, and William Briggs, statistician who worked on this with me. And what we noticed a few days ago is that according to some of the models that we're hearing about, there continues to be this kind of exponential growth, both in the number of people catching this and the number of people dying as a result of COVID-19, of the coronavirus. But we noticed that if you look at Italy, which is probably, first of all, they had a slow response, and they're probably 2 weeks ahead of us in terms of the kind of progress of the disease through the population, is that the number of deaths and the number of total cases is starting to level off. And if that holds, and we're going to know this week, one way or the other, if it levels off, the daily deaths start going down, what that means is that this virus is acting very much like other new viruses that are not hugely destructive. They kill a lot of people, but there's a kind of huge exponential spike at the beginning, and then it levels off as it works its way through the population and kills the people that are most vulnerable. And then you get an almost equally precipitous drop in the number of daily deaths on the other side. And so what we've been hearing about for a couple of weeks is exponential growth in death, but it's possible that that's what we're going to see on the other side too. If that's true, if the decline starts in Italy, then that's a really good sign for us because I think our response has been better. And what that means is we could probably predict that we might continue seeing growth in the number of cases and deaths from this, but it will level off in about 2 weeks and be back down. That has huge human implications, and it has huge implications for how we respond to this as a policy matter.
So in terms of the potential exponential growth and the concerns, and Bill Gates early on, late February, saying this could be the pandemic, the once-in-a-century pandemic that we've predicted. And then you had different models where half of Americans could be affected. So if 1 in 100 died, that would be like 15 million deaths, almost these apocalyptic-type numbers. You're looking at things with your scientific background, do you think that there is, not fear-mongering, I mean, people are doing their best to predict and things like that, but are things being overstated, or is it too early to tell?
I think that there's, even if this is, let's say this is as bad as the Spanish flu, which is last century, you know, about 100 years ago, catastrophe. Even during the Spanish flu, the response wasn't like this. The global economy did not shut down. The problem with the response we have right now is that we're going to have deaths from the coronavirus and other spill-on effects, but we're also going to have deaths because of the drastic slowdown in the global economy. And that's what I'm worried about. Saying, okay, it looks like it's not going to be as bad as we thought, that doesn't mean don't do anything. It just means that, look, the danger of overreacting is that people will die as a result of our response, just as a result of, you know, having been exposed to the virus. And that's what I'm worried about. But I know the second you say something, certainly online, that, oh, it looks like maybe this is going to level off, maybe it's not as bad as worst-case scenarios, people will accuse you of wanting to kill the elderly. And that's just extremely unhelpful, because we need to figure out exactly what's going on and make sure that our response is rational and that it's calibrated to the real risk.
So with a best-case scenario, just – again, you can only predict to a certain level. But just from your understanding and looking at things, if Americans are wondering, okay, best case scenario, maybe some of us will be back to work in normal schedules in a few weeks, maybe schools open, but life as we were used to it, you know, people going to stadium events and movie theaters and packing restaurants and things like that. How long do you think with a best case scenario it would be before that type of life is normal again?
I think that's going to be a few months. I do think the president today is talking about maybe many businesses, you know, opening back up and getting back to normal at Easter. I certainly hope that happens. We can't do this for several months. It would just be economically catastrophic. I do think it's going to take us a while, just discounting the economic effects, to get back to normal, in part because, you know, at the moment, Michael, we're not 100% sure how much immunity you get. So let's say you're healthy and you're asymptomatic, you get exposed to the virus, you've got antibodies. Does that help? Does that allow you to be permanently immune? Does that mean you're immune for 6 months or a year? We don't know that. What I'm hoping is that it actually, most people just are really not affected one way or the other. A lot of people that get slightly sick build up an immunity, and then you get this so-called herd immunity, where the population in general has an immunity to it. And so we're not carrying it around and exposing it, you know, causing other people that are in high-risk categories. That's what I'm really hoping for. But at the moment, unfortunately, those are open questions. I will say, based on the early signs, though, is I'm very much more on the optimistic side than a lot of people that we're hearing from, unfortunately, at the moment.
All right. We will be right back with Professor Jay Richards. You understand why I asked him to be on the air to speak with wisdom and expertise in these areas. When we come back, I've got a bunch of economic questions from somebody that does not understand economics well. I've got simple questions to ask. I've got the right man to answer them. We'll be right back.
Send it, Lord. It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on the Line of Fire. If you have a question for me or for Professor Jay Richards, 866-34-TRUTH. All right, Jay, I have to apologize for the basic nature of a couple of my questions. Growing up, my dad was really into the stock market, and I would ask him to explain how it worked to me. And within a few seconds, he would go too deep, and my eyes would glaze over. And I'd listen to him for minutes, but really not hear a word of it. And it's just one of these things, kind of like a black hole with me. But here's my mentality, in my ignorance, all right? You got the stock market. They understand what's healthy, what's not healthy. They understand there's a storm we have to ride out here. Why does it seem that there's this constant reaction to the news? Like, why? Again, forgive the ignorance of this question.
Sure.
But why can't the powers that be and the major players just say, hey, we're just going to stay calm during this and kind of get through the storm? Why the ups and the downs? And it seems as if it's creating its own problem. So please help us understand that.
Absolutely. I think the important thing to realize about the stock market is it is a collective thing. And so there is no one person. You might imagine there's five or six sort of key players, but this is the action of millions of people. And so it's these sort of averages. The Dow Jones is an average of a particular stock that are picked as thought to be representative of the American economy, for instance. And so these are humans, right? And so this is, you know, the economist John Maynard Keynes talked about animal spirits. What he meant is that it's ultimately we have emotions and we get mad, we get frightened. And that's true of people that have large stock portfolios as well. And so the other thing that people with stocks are doing is they're trying to anticipate what other people are thinking, right? So you might think, well, I've got the stock in this company. I think this is a really healthy company that's going to do great, but it's bad news just came out about the CEO who's died or he's committed a crime. And so everybody else is going to want to sell. And so I want to sell because I don't want to get stuck when the price goes, through the basement, and I'm stuck with these stocks that I bought at a high price. And so they're reacting emotionally, and then everyone's also trying to anticipate how others are reacting. And of course, they're going to assume everybody else is acting emotionally. And so you get, like it or not, the stock market reflects public moods. I mean, I'm always telling people this, that one of the most important things I think President Trump does when it comes to the economy, I don't agree with everything President Trump has advocated in terms of his policies, but just the kind of psychological effect that he has for people in which they feel good about the economy, that matters economically. If people feel good about things, they're more likely to take risks that make sense, or more likely to go out and try to find a job. And so, at bottom, you're dealing with psychological realities when it comes to the stock market, despite the fact that you might imagine that there's some kind of mathematical algorithm out there controlling it.
Interesting. And that absolutely explains it. I recognized last week, I heard a snippet of the press conference, and the president was touting this malaria drug and saying, hey, I feel good about this. This could really work. Okay. And then, of course, Dr. Anthony Fauci is coming up with the scientific cautions, caveats, et cetera. Well, I'm an optimistic person by nature, a faith person by nature. So I realized later that day that I was thinking, hey, we're going to get through this quickly, and it's going to be over sooner rather than later. And I asked myself, was that from the Lord, something he was showing me, putting in my heart? Was that just my human optimism, or was I influenced by the president? And it could have been a little of all the above. But certainly, when he's talking about, hey, we're going to make it, we're going to come back better than ever, okay, that's Trump, that's being who he is, that's his confidence. But you're saying, which is something I just didn't really think about, that he's trying to encourage these people. Like, he's trying to psych up these people. Like, come on, we're going to make it. Don't do the wrong thing. So that's what he's doing in these press conferences, right?
Absolutely. Yes, and he's not just thinking about people that have large assets and equities. He's thinking about the average American who may not, whose assets might be in their house or something like that. But that is exactly what he's thinking. Donald Trump has understood this, and he's understood this for decades. He communicates at a kind of sub-vocal level almost with people. The Dilbert cartoon guy, Scott Adams, understood this early on prior to the election in 2016, that Donald Trump has a intangible way of communicating over social media, over television, that is what gives him his power, I think, and it's kind of compelling nature for so many people. And I think that's exactly what he's trying to do. That's why it's sort of awkward, but he's in these press conferences and he's there with these scientists talking about these things, but he's also kind of giving his own take on things, even in real time. I actually think this is a good thing. And I think in the long run, we will be thankful that he did that, because the reality is that most people can't follow epidemiological details,
Right.
And we're just trying to decide, okay, do I need to panic or do I need to just prepare and hope for the best? And what the president wants us to do is prepare, be careful, do what's wise, but still hope for the best, because the country's not going anywhere.
All right. So two last questions relating to the economy. Again, based on my ignorance of how these larger things run, I'm thinking, okay, whenever we restart, we just restart and people are going to kind of go crazy buying, doing things, pumping things up, and the economy can get going quickly again. But obviously there are points from which it's difficult to return. There's damage that's done that it's hard to repair. So where are we at in that balance right now?
I would say we're a couple of weeks away from catastrophe, because we can get these government responses where, say, everybody's given a check for a few $1,000 from the government. That doesn't mean there's going to be anything to buy if the factories haven't been working. That's the problem. Because if we're not producing, there's not going to be anything to buy, and that extra money is just actually going to create inflation. It's not going to feed the economy. So that's what I'm worried about, the productive capacity of the country just going on hold here for several weeks. That's going to take some time to get that back up and running.
But you feel, though, that based on what the president is hoping to do, that can be turned around, and that some of the optimism that he's portraying is not just empty words, but there's substance that we could really bounce back strongly.
Absolutely. I mean, we're a powerful country. We're a highly productive country. We are the center of innovation on the planet. We worry about the status of the dollar, but it's still used as a reserve currency because it's more secure than any other. And so I don't have any doubts about the fundamental the strength of our economy. It's just that there's these kind of basic realities. If you've got, 20% of the population, for instance, is suddenly on unemployment and without a job, and we haven't been producing, then, just imagine you're in a town and the mayor gives everybody $10,000 and says, go out and buy yourself a car with $10,000. But it's the same number of cars that were there the first day before. So we don't have new cars. So what you have is more money chasing the same goods, and all that's going to do is raise the cost of the goods that are still there. So what you want is not just people having money to spend, but products that have actually been produced. The economy comes from productivity and from creating wealth, and then people having wealth to be able to purchase it. It doesn't come just from us having money to spend, because if all we have is a lot of money to spend and there's the same number of goods, that just creates inflation, unfortunately.
Got it. All right, last question then. So that second one was a follow-up to the first, just to be technical here. All right, so here's the way I think. You ask someone, why did you vote for President Trump? They say, well, because of his pro-life stance. I said, okay, that was moral. Why did you vote for President Trump? I thought he'd be good for the economy. I'm thinking, well, you voted your pocketbook. In other words, one thing is more selfish. The other thing is more spiritual. One thing is more thinking about others. The other is more thinking about ourselves. Now, many do vote their pocketbook in a superficial way, just thinking, hey, I want more money in my pocket, and I want to do better than ever. The American dream, bigger and better. But you're saying that there's a real connection between economics and morality, and that lives are really at stake. So just to open that up for us.
Absolutely. And in fact, I think that's the most important thing I think people need to remember, is that the president's not saying, well, how many elderly people am I willing to let die in order to improve the stock market? That is not the calculation, because the well-being of the economy is the well-being of people, and it's especially the well-being of the people that are at the very bottom rungs of the economic ladder. And so what happens in the economy has a real human cost. Now, we actually know from studies, we all imagine that everybody else votes their pocketbook, they just think about their private self-interest and vote. The reality is that actually most people vote, for good or for ill, they think they're voting for the candidate that's the best one for the common good. So not just the best for them, but the best for other people. And so really, it's not that lots of Americans are hoping to destroy the economy or the society. They just misunderstand or disagree about what the best policies are. That's why I think, Michael, that economics is so important, because it's only with economics that we can learn to distinguish between meaning to do well and actually doing well. That is, advocating policies that sound nice but hurt people, and advocating policies that will actually improve things in the long run.
All right, so to just follow through on that, I could understand now where economic issues could be a matter of life and death, that if you can't produce certain things or get certain medicine out or ventilators or whatever it is, or that certain people that are more impoverished won't get care. But just in 1 minute, in everyday life, if the country is more prosperous, how does that actually save lives?
Just think in terms of healthcare, actually. If people are spending less money of their total income on food, if they're spending less of their total income on real estate and all these other things, they have more money actually to spend on healthcare. We have more money actually to spend on healthcare research. So that's a kind of a very direct way of thinking about it. But in a more practical way, let's assume you're retired and you have limited income. Suddenly your 401k drops and you have less money. Now all of a sudden you're making compromises in which you're not going to the doctor when you should. And so you're more likely to actually die than if you hadn't been in that circumstance. It's hard to realize that, but you're not direct situations where one person killed another person. It's just a result of knock-on effects from bad economics in which people die that wouldn't have died otherwise.
Yeah, well put, Jay. Thank you so much, not just for having the knowledge, but for breaking it down for people like me in some of these areas. Much appreciated, and keep up the awesome work. Friends, read Jay Richards at stream.org. Check out his books. All right, stay busy, stay safe. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on The Line of Fire. If you're just tuning in and joining us now, please go to our YouTube channel, Ask Dr. Brown, AskDR Brown, and later today, go back and listen to my half-hour interview with Professor Jay Richards, breaking down things for us scientifically, economically. For me, so helpful in so many ways. He's a brilliant guy, well-learned in a number of fields, real polymath, but able to break things down with real simplicity so that anyone can follow. 866-34-TRUTH. Here's what we're going to do. I do have a few things I want to share with you in terms of what I believe God is saying to us. I can do a better job on the theological and biblical end than I can on the economic and scientific end, obviously. So I'm going to weigh in with some thoughts I think are important. I take your calls relative to the times in which we're living. But if you have a question of any kind for me, completely, totally unrelated to coronavirus and everything else, phone lines are open, 866-34-TRUTH. So Howard, you don't have to be careful in terms of who you let on. If, as long as the connection is good and the question is relevant, we'll take calls. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Joe in Virginia. Thanks for calling The Line of Fire.
Hello, Dr. Brown. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
All right. So I had a question. I was recently watching the Robinson Report on TV last night. The host is Steve Robinson. And he had a Dr. Matthew Carano on, and he recently did a study about how music can help in this time of isolation with everybody being in their homes. He said that music can help relieve stress, and let me tell you this, I was all aboard with this study of Dr. Matthew Carano. But however, when he mentioned this to the host, Steve Robinson, he was making an absolute parody of the guy, and Steve usually calls himself to be a truth guy, but in this way and form, I think that Steve's a liar guy in this way and form, making a parody out of Dr. Matthew Carano, and I just think that music can really help in this time of need. I was just wondering if I could get your takes on that, because I think that we really need to find that Goldilocks zone between being going crazy and not taking it seriously enough. Like, I mean, we all need to be in our house, taking this isolation and all this stuff seriously so nobody gets sick. And I realize that things take time, but I was wondering, what is your opinion on this?
Yeah, I can actually weigh in on this with some degree of expertise, having written a book on the power of music, God's Call to Change the World One Song at a Time, and then having devoted a specific chapter in the book to how music affects the brain. I also talk about how music has been used as a means of torture. You know, this is the repetitive playing of loud music and what's that done. And so positive effects, negative effects. So first, there is no debate. There's no denying that music does affect the brain in unique ways. It affects all of the brain in ways that very few other things do. So we know that just common sense tells you that you're watching a movie.
Right,
and,
right.
And, you know, here's what's going on. You've got a mom playing with her couple little kids in the backyard, okay? And everything seems fine, but suddenly the music is tense. And it's like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? Now, if you turn the sound down, everything seems fine. But suddenly you're, what's going to happen? It's the music did it. And you can have joyful music has a certain effect on you. You got some weightlifter. He's about to try to set a world record. They got this heavy metal.
And then you've watched Bicentennial Man the other day, and they had some great music in that movie.
Yeah. So in any case, it has. I looked at books like Music, the Brain, and Ecstasy, how music captures our imagination, Music in the Mind, This is Your Brain on Music, The Science of a Human Obsession, The World in Six Songs, How the Musical Brain Created Human Nature, and on and on. All these books that I bought and looked at in writing my book on the power of music. Here's from one book called Music in the Mind by Storr. Music stimulates the mind, captivates the heart, and nurtures the soul. A distinguished psychiatrist ponders why. So here he's looking at it from a psychiatric or psychological viewpoint. But basically, studies have been done, say, with kids at home with classical music in the background and how that affects their performance. Other musics have been tried out. People, say, elderly or people with Alzheimer's or different things like that. And then music has had a positive effect to help restore brain activity. So, Joe, in obviously, I haven't the slightest clue in terms of how music could affect someone in ICU dying of COVID-19, of course. But those of us shut in our homes, those of us disrupted from our normal schedule, those of us with kids running around, music makes a massive difference emotionally, psychologically. And if there's an emotional and psychological effect, that has a physical effect as well. These things are all related. And we know in the Bible the importance of music in terms of worship and connecting with God. So, yeah, I have no idea why this gentleman would poo-poo this. My book, The Power of Music, I really lay it out, document it. Let's prayerfully and carefully use music now with wisdom in our homes, with our families, with our children, us alone. It'll make a massive difference in the atmosphere. So, Joe, thank you so much about the for your call. 866-34-TRUTH. We'll go over to Canada with Danny. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hi there, Dr. Brown. How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
Great. Question about the coronavirus. So I've been getting some private messages from some Christian friends. One in particular keeps sending me things like the RFID chip, Mark of the Beast, coronavirus is government made for martial law. That's nonsense. Complete nonsense, I think. But with whatever response I give, I get, you know, laugh out loud, you're brainwashed, you're listening to mainstream media, things like that. So, yeah. And this is the fellow that's doing this, and there's lots of them, but the guy who's doing it, I love him. New friend, having a hard time. And so, we're trying to help him. We're in the ministry, trying to minister to the guy. But now he's really thinking we're all deceived. And so how would you respond to Christians in particular that come out with these real far-fetched conspiracy theories? How would you effectively do that?
Thank you for asking, Danny. And be assured that I get the same stuff sent to me, but on steroids, just because of our public platform. So whether it's a warning from a pastor with a good track record saying he has scientific information and information from high sources in the government, if a vaccine comes out, don't take it. That's not just a rumor. That's actually telling you don't take the vaccine. Is the vaccine going to save your life or kill you? I mean, these are big questions. And then the mark of the beast, and then plagues of Revelation, and then various things. I just read an article. Here's why we know for sure that this was not manufactured in a lab. I've heard from others know it was manufactured in a lab. And I mean, how are we going to, how in the world, how can we possibly, you and I, know, right? So here's the way I would respond to someone. Now, bear in mind, I've been around long enough that this is like the 30th time I've heard about the mark of the beast and the chip and the implant, and this is going to be the key for it or the international currency. And so far, none of them have come true yet. So what I might do is do a little research. Let's say I'm really trying to help people here, okay? To say, hey, please help me understand something. You know, in 1971, we were told this. In 1983, we were, and like the exact same warning. This is the chip, the mark of the bit, whatever. This is it. And say, so just curious, how, those didn't pan out. Why are you so sure this is going to pan out? Let's just get the person to start thinking rationally. Or I would, this is one technique, to try to get them to realize, hey, this is not the first time we've been through this, okay? This is a little different, but this is not the first time we've been through certain crisis. And, with End Time Prophecy, there are books written that show how Christians were saying, that's it, this is the end during World War II. And Mussolini was going to be the head of the false Roman Empire and Hitler the false prophet and all this stuff. It's like, well, that was a terrible time, but it wasn't the end of the world. So that's one thing. Get them to think like this. The other is to play the same game to have some other equally extreme theory, but that's the opposite, and say, man, that's scary. Yeah. But I just heard this, man. And then it's, again, with the goal being to try to wake the person up to realize, okay, hang on, this is just theory that's out there. And with something this volatile, there's going to be every conspiracy theory, from the Jews are behind it, to this was a weapon of mass destruction from China, this was a Democrat plot to take down the president, this is a secret cabal of generals that have been working on this for years. I mean, there's endless theory and speculation. And if it's someone that is more rational in their approach, right, I just say, yeah, I'm hearing a lot of different things. So I'm just praying for wisdom, doing what I know is right to do here. And let's just really pray that this will flush out. You know, if the person is more rational, I'd approach it in that way. So one way is give them information, get them to realize that we've heard these theories before. Another is to hit them with equally wacky theories. And another is to say, you know, this is really serious stuff. So I'm really praying. But here's what I know. Here's the way I'm living. My family's living. This is wisdom, and we're in faith, and we're going to keep an eye on all these things and just try to calm it down a little. Beyond that, you know, it's like trying to put out 100 fires at once. It's a little hard to do.
Thank you so much. That is spot on. I'm going to use one of those. Thank you so much.
You bet. And by the way, just an announcement. I'm actually writing a book. Hope to finish it by the end of this week and have it out, at least in e-form, within the next week or 10 days on the virus, on the Bible, on the end of the world, on how we should live, on faith versus fear, wisdom. Yeah, I'm not traveling. I would have been leaving for Lagos, Nigeria today or tomorrow, something like that. So I'm busy, of course, super busy, but I'm not traveling. So I've got more time than normal. So I'm hoping to put out a whole book and get it out very, very quickly. I've been writing articles talking about things. So, all right, we're going to come back. I'm going to get you your calls. And I want to lay out just a few thoughts on what we need to grab in this moment. I've been talking about it a lot. Don't just count, when can we get back to life as normal? Let's seize the moment in this abnormal time to live differently. That's A. And B, let's seize the moment to learn what we can to live differently when life goes back to, quote, normal. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on The Line of Fire, 866-34-TRUTH. It is our goal by God's grace to be your voice of moral sanity and spiritual clarity in the midst of a society in chaos and a church all too often in compromise. So pray with us. If you're able to stand with us, I know many are under economic pressure and challenge right now, so we're all in this together. But if you can stand with us to help us continue what we're doing and supporting our workers, missionaries, and others working around the world, often sacrificially, making a real impact, you're standing with us makes a massive difference. So pray. If you're able to stand with us, go to askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. Click on donate, and every dollar will be used for the glory of God and to advance the kingdom and to continue to be your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. All right. I want to say this again. Some of us, kids at home, not working, schedules upside down, we're just counting the minutes for life to get back to normal. And I do understand that. And some are in very difficult, challenging situations. But I want to encourage you in these unusual times to seize the moment. Maybe you watched a lot of sports. Maybe you went to the movies a lot. Maybe you spent a lot of time out at restaurants. Maybe there are lots of things you did that were secondary, were not necessary to the sustaining of your own life. Now you have more time on your hands. Or you have a situation where you're stuck around each other more as family. Seize the moment. Use the time to get with the Lord. use the time to stop and slow down life and think about what really matters before the rat race starts again. Use the time to make quality investments in relationships, in family, in the time you have. Also for pastors and leaders. Yeah, I understand these are challenging times and we have church lives and our buildings are often busy day and night, things going on, and now those aren't going on, so it's challenging. And many are saying, hey, we're using live stream and we're networking in different ways. Wonderful. Do it. I'm using live stream even more. I mean, we use it all the time anyway, but using it even more to communicate even more with people home more and trying to minister more and give more and serve more in these capacities. But it's also good to ask questions about, okay, what's the church really supposed to be? Who are we really? I just wrote a chapter about that last night to put in this book that I'm writing to come out immediately on the virus and our response to it as believers. Are there different ways to do things? Should we put more emphasis on meetings at home? Should we put more emphasis on being in our community? Should we put more emphasis on being the church than simply gathering together? Please understand, I love gathering together. I'm all for gathering. I love public gatherings. I love preaching in big churches. I've preached in some of the finest mega churches around the world with fine leaders doing a fine work and reaching the lost and making disciples and helping communities and doing wonderfully. And I work closely with leaders in house church networks. So I'm all for working in as many different places, settings as possible. I love coming together with a gifted worship team that loves the Lord and is anointed and worshiping with thousands of people. If I can speak to 10,000 people in one shot, as opposed to go from city to city to city to city, speak to 200 at a time, awesome, wonderful. I love it. But I also know that's not all there is to church. I also know, in fact, that most of what church is lived out outside of the four walls of a building. That while gathering together is important, we can gather together in many different ways as well. So look, I have a radio show. We have an online show. I have TV shows. So I have no problem with saying, hey, here's someone speaking to thousands or millions of people at the same time. And if God's raised you up as a leader, as a pastor, and you have campuses where between your physical meetings and satellites, you're speaking to 50,000 people a week. Awesome. Deliver the word the Lord gives you. May he use you. May you build up the people of God and reach the lost. Go for it. Absolutely. I'm cheering you on. But I'm also saying that a lot of the way we do church ends up being somewhat superficial. That a lot of the way that we do church ends up not really making disciples in the most quality way. And that this is a great time for pastors, leaders, not just to figure out how to make do at the moment and how to serve your people and your communities at the moment, which is obviously big questions, but also to ask, how can we grow? How can we be the church more effectively? What if God just shut down the big meetings entirely? What if we couldn't live stream? What would we do? How is it the church has grown for centuries without live streaming and without big buildings? Many parts of the world to this day, that's how it's growing. So just questions to ask so that we can come out of this better than when we went into it. All right? 866-34-TRUTH. Let's see. Let us go to Susan in California. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hello. Thank you so much for your program.
You're welcome.
Question is in regards to spiritual warfare. And I have heard some Christian ministers teach on the spirit of Leviathan and the spirit of Python. And I was wondering, is this scripturally accurate?
Yes and no. Here's the yes. Certainly the Old Testament knows a demonic power called Leviathan. He's mentioned in Isaiah 27:1, and the Lord defeats him. He's represented in Canaanite mythology as a seven-headed dragon. We see images of that in the book of Job. There's a debate about exactly who Leviathan is at the end of the book of Job, but earlier in Job, Leviathan is mentioned as one of these chaos powers, these demonic powers. So it would seem that in the demonic realm, there's something, someone that is identified as Leviathan. So that's one thing. As for, quote, a python spirit, there's a Greek word that relates to that in Acts 16 with a woman with a spirit of divination. But it's not, it is not saying that there's a spirit out there called the python spirit, okay? So here's where I think things can get weird and wacky, And here's where I think we can have spiritual insight, all right? I think things get weird and wacky when we try to put a name on everything that's happening and start naming all kinds of demons and say this demon operates like this and this demon operates like that. So before you know it, you've got a handbook where you're fighting like 40 different demons by name, you know? And it's like, which one is that? Before we buy, we better look that one up. That gets weird, wacky, and to me, does no good, okay?
Yeah.
On the flip side, there's no question that Satan has an organized army and works in systematic ways. Ephesians 6:12 indicates really a hierarchical structure in the spiritual realm. That's what we're battling. And when I wrote my book, Jezebel's War with America, I made clear we're not talking about the ghost of Jezebel, but the same coalition of demonic forces that work through Jezebel are clearly working again today. Or if there was a principality or demonic stronghold cult, you know, that we're identifying as Jezebel, that's just the name we're putting on it, that stronghold, that principality is operating again today. In other words, look at the symptoms. Look at what's happening. So someone talks about, quote, the Python spirit. I don't see that as a biblical concept. However, if they talk about you're under this attack, right, and it is suffocating you, and it's doing, and so they give all the symptoms, just like a doctor says, are you suffering from this, 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 this? Yes. Okay, let's do blood tests. Do you have all the symptoms? Let's do that. Let's use this medicine. So what's happening is people are going to the extreme with naming everything and so on, which again, I think goes too far. On the flip side, there are things that they're rightly identifying symptomatically, and that sometimes when we now recognize what we're dealing with, like, in other words, the reason I wrote about the whole Jezebel thing was to say, connect the dots. Let's recognize what we're dealing with spiritually. And then when you recognize it, you can more holistically fight it and oppose it instead of flailing here and flailing there and flailing there. So I think if we can demythologize a little bit, not get caught up with the names and the titles, and recognize more the reality of what we're battling with spiritually, then I can derive something helpful. I heard a guy years ago preach on the Python spirit, first time I ever heard about it, in the 90s. And while I rejected his exegetical and linguistic method, his overall message was great. And we were really in a very intense battle financially with our ministry, and personally some things had really hit hard that really described this Python kind of thing. So I thought, okay, even though the way he got to his main point, he didn't use the Greek properly, his overall point was accurate. This is what we were dealing with spiritually, and we resisted it in Jesus' name. So get the take the good out of it without the weird and wacky.
Okay. Thank you so much. God bless you.
God bless. Thanks. 866-34-TRUTH. By the way, just got a great testimony from one of our online students. And if you have time to take classes, now's a great time. FireSchoolOfMinistry.com. Enroll in the program. It's an amazing program. We've taken all of our best classes, put them online for you, and it's just a wonderful place to be. FireSchoolOfMinistry.com. But one of our students, 70-ish, her husband is early 70s, had a number of respiratory prior conditions, comes down with the virus. He's got symptoms, you know, fatigue, body ache, fever. His wife starts to get sick. A pastor calls up, prays for the wife over the phone. She's instantly healed. Next day, which is, I guess, today now, husband completely healed. So that was good news to get. All right, listen, I am going to keep taking your calls tomorrow. Phone lines are jammed, but we're literally out of time. So I want to take as many calls as I can tomorrow. So I'm just looking at the board here and, all right, getting your names in my head. So if you call tomorrow, I'll do my best to bump you up. But very special announcement. Tonight, 7 p.m., so just 3 hours from now, on the S. Dr. Brown YouTube channel, I'm going to be doing a live stream talking about my new book, Resurrection, but giving some Jewish perspectives on the resurrection of Jesus, some Jewish traditions, things you've never heard before, and then using this to bring a new argument that supports the resurrection of Jesus, Yeshua. That'll be 7 p.m., so just 3 hours from 7 p.m. Eastern time, live stream on the Ask Dr. Brown, ASK Dr. Brown YouTube channel. I will see you again shortly.